Hello, and welcome to Green Minds, the student-led podcast dedicated to thought-provoking conversations on climate and sustainability. I'm your host, Lorenzo, and today we have a special episode as part of our Around the World series. Around the World is a series of four episodes where we interview students studying the MSc in Climate Change, Management and Finance at Imperial College Business School to hear more about the impacts of climate change and mitigation and adaptation actions in the countries that they call home. This is the second episode in our series, following my co-host Ava's episode focused on climate adaptation. The theme for today's episode is nature-based solutions. They will also cover other areas that interact. But before we go on, I hear some people asking, what do we mean by nature-based solutions? To answer that, I found a useful definition from the Nature-Based Solutions Initiative, which I'll read out verbatim. Nature-based solutions involve working with nature as part of nature to address societal challenges, supporting human well-being and biodiversity locally. They include the protection, restoration or management of natural and semi-natural ecosystems, the sustainable management of aquatic systems and working lands, and integration of nature in and around our cities. They are actions that are underpinned by biodiversity and designed and implemented in a way that respects the rights, values and knowledges of local communities and Indigenous peoples. So that's the definition to keep in mind throughout the episode. And of course, the societal challenge we're particularly interested in on this podcast is climate change and how nature-based solutions can help mitigate the effects of climate change by sequestering carbon dioxide and also support communities to build resilience to the impacts of climate change. So we have three more great guests from the Imperial College Business School's MSc in Climate Change Management and Finance to talk us through nature-based solutions in the context of their countries. I'm now going to ask each of them to introduce themselves, the country they call home, and the nature-based solutions themed icebreaker, which is as follows. What is your favourite nature-based place or activity? And I'm going to start with nothing short of podcast royalty, because today we have the host of the Centre for Climate Finance and Investments, New Frontiers in Climate Finance podcast, Angel Miao. Angel, it's fantastic to have you on the podcast. Would you like to introduce yourself to the listeners?
Thanks, Lorenzo. It's great to be here. So I'm from Canada, and although I've lived in three very different provinces, my favorite outdoor place in Canada is one really close to where I grew up in British Columbia. So it's called Joffrey Lakes Provincial Park. And there's this hike that you can do that leads you past three glacier-fed lakes. So the water is this really cool and unbelievable kind of turquoise. And in the background, you can see snow-capped mountains and, you know, like evergreens. And it's just like really amazing.
Amazing. Yeah, sounds truly postcard worthy. Sticking to the theme of podcast hosts, next up is someone who's going to be a future co-host on the Green Minds podcast. So a very warm welcome to Lawrence Denyer. Lawrence, would you like to say hello to the audience?
Yeah, thank you very much for having me, first of all. Hello, everyone. My favourite place in the UK has to be a little place north of Abergavenny in the Brecon Beacons in Wales, where I've been going camping since I was like 1 year old. There's literally nothing there in the middle of nowhere. You get your water from the river, and I've just been going there for years. And I've taken friends there, and like they've asked me where it is afterwards. And it's like within my family, it's like a complete secret. Like you're not allowed to tell anyone like how you get there, like whatsoever. So it's like basically it's a tightly held secret exactly where the campsite is. But yeah, it's definitely my favourite place. It's like the sound of the river, just sleeping in the tent and just going walks and also running across the Brecon Beacons. So yeah, amazing.
Intriguing. Yeah, Brecon Beacons is a classic UK summer holiday. So that sounds amazing. And to cap off our stellar cast today, we have someone who's very much a friend of the Green Minds podcast, because we have a co-host from episode 8 of the Green Minds podcast, which was with Winsim Tan. So we're welcoming back Q Wong. So Q, a very warm welcome back to the Green Minds family. Would you like to say hello to the Green Minds audience?
Thanks, Lorenzo. I'm glad to be back here again. You've got to say, Angel, British Columbia is pretty hard to beat. It's probably my favourite area outside of home, and I've spent a whole week doing day hikes from Whistler. But after coming to the UK, I've really started to miss the tropical forests we have at home. One of my favourite hikes is called Gunung Nuang. And it's this fascinating trail that lasts for about 10 hours with like a 1500 meter ascent. It takes you from muddy trails to mossy greens, and then you have stray dogs who accompany you all the way to the peak so that they get food. And when you've done the whole trail and you reach the foot of the mountain, you get to swim in waters with They're the waterfalls, they give you a free massage. It's amazing.
Brilliant. Thanks very much, Q, and thanks all for your favourite nature-based places. They all sound incredible. I think we've probably done a bad job of discouraging people to fly, given the nature of this podcast. But let's crack on with the theme for today, which is nature-based solutions. I'll start with you, Q. So when you submitted your interest in being part of this series covering Malaysia, you described Malaysia as being a mega diverse country. And I'm interested in starting off with what mega diverse means. And if you could also tell us about Malaysia's biodiversity, perhaps with some personal reflections weaved in.
So the technical definition of mega diverse is that the country has to have at least 5,000 endemic species of plants, which means that plants that can only be found in that specific area. And the country must also border marine ecosystems. And the most famous endemic plant in Malaysia is probably the rafflesia, which is also the largest flower in the world. And finally, apart from having the smelliest fruit, the durian, we also have the smelliest flower, the rafflesia. And that's how it got its nickname. It's called the corpse flower. It's a parasite plant that spans about 3 feet long, has no roots, and swallows flies and insects for sustenance. But despite its size, it's actually incredibly difficult to spot, just because it only blooms about every 6 to 9 months and it decomposes after 4 days. And apart from plants, Malaysia is known for its orangutans, Malayan tigers, tapirs, pygmy elephants, and also the hornbills. And up till a few years ago, we actually still had a Sumatra rhinoceros, but we lost the last one in 2019 after decades of illegal poaching and habitat loss.
Thanks, Q. That's really set the scene. And I want to continue on this point, and in particular, talk about deforestation. When I was doing research for this episode, I read that Malaysia had the highest deforestation rate in the world between the years 2000 and 2012, and it lost just over 14% of its tree cover. To give you a sense, that's an area larger than Denmark, which I found staggering. Could you tell us about the causes of deforestation in Malaysia and the impacts it's having?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up, Lorenzo. I think in the last decade, that number has actually doubled to 30% of tree cover loss, so larger than Austria now. And one third of that is actually humid primary forests. Deforestation in Malaysia is actually largely commodity driven, so mainly logging for timber and also for palm oil plantations. And funny enough, when you grow up as a kid in Malaysia, you don't really question palm oil plantations as an evil thing, just because they look green and you associate green with healthy ecosystems. But as you grow older and you realize how bad palm oil is, and everyone's talking about it, the fact is that globally we're so addicted to it. We each consume about 8 kilograms a year on average, because it's everywhere. It's in about 50% of packaged food products. And to give you an idea of how difficult it is to get rid of palm oil, the supermarket chain Iceland in 2018, they pledged to remove palm oil from its own brand products by the end of the year. And then they failed to meet their own deadline, and they removed the brand Iceland from those products that they couldn't remove palm oil instead. So coming back to the situation in Malaysia, we actually have a National Forestry Act to promote sustainable forestry, but this policy actually sits at the federal level, and state governments are the ones who have sole authority over land use. And more often than not, lands and forests are the only source of income for them. And in some states, this is made more complicated by politicking and corruption issues surrounding timber licenses, of which we're not going to go into today. But there is hope. One of the triumphs for conservation in Malaysia last year was a settlement reached with a timber company, which had sued an environmental campaign group called Save Rivers for defamation. And Save Rivers, a few years back, they had also lobbied against a hydroelectric dam construction, which would have flooded 40,000 hectares of forests. And all in all, this is just a testament to the power of communities coming together.
Yes, that's a great point to finish on. And I think the importance of community-driven action is something that we're going to hear about throughout this episode, in particular with regards to Canada. So let's pivot on to asking Angel a few questions. Angel, could you start by giving us an overview of Canada and its nature? I appreciate Canada is a very big country, but if you could just give us an overview of what its nature-based solutions look like.
Yeah, so thanks, Lorenzo. As you said, Canada is a very large country. It's actually the second largest country in the world. So within Canada, the kind of nature you're going to see is going to vary from coast to coast. It's divided into 20 ecozones, but for simplicity, we're just going to say that there's four major biomes. So starting from the most north, we have the tundra. So the Canadian tundra is found above the Arctic Circle, and the soil in this region is mostly permafrost or soil that remains frozen all year round. What's unfortunate is that climate change poses an immense threat to this region, as it could thaw the permafrost and release the trapped GHGs that can further accelerate global warming. So what's also interesting to note about the tundra is that it's the traditional home of many indigenous communities, predominantly Inuit peoples. And very sadly, quality of life is extremely poor for these communities, and they're extremely dependent on hunting and fishing as means of feeding themselves. Just below the tundra is the vast boreal forest of Canada, which covers about 60% of the country's land area. And it stretches diagonally all the way from near Alaska to near Quebec, or in Quebec in the southeast. So it's considered to be the largest intact forest on Earth, with about 3 million square kilometers that are undisturbed by anthropogenic activities. So that's an incredible opportunity for large-scale conservation. So the boreal forest has an important role to play in climate change, since both the trees and the soil are massive carbon sinks. Next, we have the grasslands, which are found in the central southern region of Canada. We call them the prairies, and they're characterized by open areas of grass, which support many endangered species like bisons or foxes or owls. So unfortunately, again, Canada has lost 75% of its native grassland. Similar to Kew, it's been converted to like cropland or to support livestock, which as a child, you don't think that that's bad, but like learning more about it, it is just a huge waste of land. And actually, temperate grasslands have been declared the world's most endangered ecosystem. And next is the temperate deciduous forest. So it's found in southeast Canada and it's characterized by deciduous plants that lose their leaves in the winter. It's not that big of a region, but a large proportion of Canada's population actually live in this biome. So anthropogenic disturbances are really important and a dominant factor in determining forest health. So yeah, I mean, that's kind of like a Canada Nature 101, but I guess the main takeaway is that Canada is abundant in natural resources and has an important role to play in natural carbon sequestration.
Fantastic overview. Thanks very much, Angel. And now I want to turn to a different cause of forest destruction to the one we discussed with Q with regards to Canada, and that's recent forest fires. And this is another topic where you do some research online and the numbers are absolutely frightening. So I read that the wildfires we saw last year in 2023 saw 45.7 million acres or 18.5 million hectares going up in flames, which is an area about twice the size of Portugal, which shattered the previous annual record nearly three times over. It'd be great to hear about your personal experiences of forest fires in Canada, how it's also impacted carbon release, as well as local communities and biodiversity.
Yeah, I mean, it's devastating to see. And I guess disclaimer for anyone listening, maybe you want to cuddle a puppy or something now, because the stats I'm about to rattle off are actually just really, really depressing. But I guess personally, I remember growing up as a kid in Vancouver, there was just one August when I was, you know, maybe 10 or 11, where the smoke from the forest fires in the interior of British Columbia just kind of like made the sky so gray and turned the sun red, kind of like something like in Tatooine or in Star Wars. But so that first year, people were so scared and worried and they were wearing face masks and everything. But over time, people just got conditioned to it. And it's almost expected that that's going to happen every year. But last year, as I'm sure many of you have seen, was particularly bad. So 2023 was the most destructive year for Canadian wildfires ever recorded. So unlike previous years, I mean, in British Columbia, it happens very often, but in other provinces, not. But every single one of Canada's 13 provinces and territories had wildfires in them. So as an example, so where I was living in Quebec, more land was burned in June 2023 than the previous 20 years combined. Here are the depressing statistics. So when the forests burn, the sequestered carbon in them is obviously released back into the atmosphere. Last year, Canada released 2 billion tons of carbon dioxide, which is triple what our annual carbon footprint or in a normal year is. And the fumes from the smoke affect biodiversity as well, because it affects the health of the wildlife and it affects the migration patterns of those animals, and obviously it destroys their home. For humans, the air pollution and water pollution are also huge problems, so leading to higher risk of health problems. And it also increases the risk of flooding. So in 2021, there were these catastrophic floods in Vancouver, in southern British Columbia, where I'm from. So these floods were made worse by the forest fires that happened the summer before, because the fire cooks the soil and it bakes it in really hard. So then when you actually experience the intense rains, the soil can't absorb that moisture anymore. So it just gathers above ground. Again, another depressing thing is that what's more is that when a forest gets older, the more resilient it gets against the wildfires. So with every summer that the trees burn down, the wildfires actually making the forest more susceptible and less resilient in future years, because the forest needs the time to grow without external disturbances. I'll say it's almost offensive how clear it is that the government needs to be taking greater and more aggressive actions for better wildlife management measures.
Thanks, Angel. I suspect listeners will have to hold on to that puppy for pretty much all of this episode, because sadly that is not the end of just the devastating consequences of climate change. Thank you for that overview. And a follow-up question, you've really touched upon the differing impacts of climate change on different communities. You mentioned that the Canadian tundra is the traditional home of many Indigenous communities. Could you talk through the disproportionate impacts that climate change is having on Indigenous communities in Canada?
Yeah, so Canada, I don't know if listeners know this, but Canada has had a very unsavory track record when it comes to the treatment of Indigenous population. And I just want to highlight some of the challenges that these communities face with respect to climate change, and particularly, I think I'll focus on wildfires. So although, you know, only 5% of Canada's population is Indigenous communities, these communities have accounted for almost half of wildfire evacuations in the past decade. So this is happening primarily because of location. So Canada's Indigenous communities, 80% of them live on or near forested lands, which make them very vulnerable to the impacts of wildfires. So many of these communities are also remote and they only have one or two serviceable roads for evacuation purposes. If any, many of them have to be evacuated by plane. And when these rampant wildfires happen, like they did last summer, the fire response, like resources are very stretched. So they're usually drawn to larger urban communities just purely because of triage reasons. But the impacts that these communities face are also important to highlight. So these communities, more so than non-Indigenous peoples, are much more attached to the land because it's deeply intertwined with their cultural and spiritual rights. And from a health perspective, compared to non-Indigenous peoples, Indigenous communities experience a much higher rate of chronic respiratory diseases. So the exposure to the wildfire smoke can exacerbate the effects of these conditions. So it's really important that the government thinks about how we can best service these communities when these wildfires occur going forward. So policy also has a role in this inequality. When the Canadian government makes decisions about wildfire management, they've historically not involved Indigenous communities in this process. So the decided upon measures obviously don't service them. But we have much to learn actually from Indigenous peoples, and people are slowly realizing this. Indigenous people have had a longstanding cultural practice of like cultural burning, where they purposely initiate low intensity, small scale burns to help lessen the fuel loads of the forest and help reduce the risk of high intensity, widespread dangerous fires. But many of these traditional fire stewardship practices are forbidden under Canadian law and are no longer practiced. So we need to reintroduce these methods in policy because they've been effective for centuries to lessen the impact.
Interesting. I think you highlight an important point about how failures in policymaking can be very easy to do when communities are not listened to. And it's also a reminder that central to this is social justice. You made me think about the project on climate adaptation we're all doing. Our group is looking at Johannesburg and how it's really interesting because the legacy of apartheid over there is that you have certain neighbourhoods where you have community being predominantly black, where you have houses that are clustered close together, you have a lack of green space, and therefore they're much more vulnerable to heat stress compared to neighbourhoods where you have predominantly white populations, where you have spacious buildings, vegetation to provide shade. And I guess a reminder that climate change cannot be addressed properly without considering the intersectionality with social justice. So we've heard from Q and Angel about what you could probably describe as green carbon or green nature-based solutions. So, you know, solutions in the terrestrial ecosystem. But we're now going to talk a bit about what we call blue carbon, which is about marine and coastal systems' role in sequestering carbon. I'm going to turn to Lawrence about this and talk about the UK. Obviously, the UK is an island, so blue carbon solutions are going to be crucial. And in particular, we're going to talk a bit about the role of seagrass in sequestering carbon around the British coast. So, Lawrence, could you tell us why it's so important to mitigating climate change and promoting biodiversity?
Yeah, sure. So I suppose one thing to note, but the reason blue carbon is so important for the UK is obviously the UK is an island, and actually the vast majority of our land carbon storage has been lost over just a millennia of just farming, and 80% of our land being used for farmland, which actually degrades the environment and reduces the amount of carrying capacity that the on land soils have, where old growth forests have been cut down. But as I said, so carbon stores within in the English North Sea amounts to nearly 20% of that held within the UK's forests and woodlands. 80% of the total organic carbon stored is actually stored in the sediments and the seabed sediments, like sand and mud. And seabeds and sediments are thus by far the most important habitat for carbon storage in the region around the coasts. Unfortunately, in the same way that on land there's been quite a lot of biodiversity loss, and in that way the UK is probably much further ahead in its journey compared to Malaysia and Canada, where we've lost over 90% of all of our seagrass, which goes around the shores, which usually grows in most shallow beds around the UK. Yeah, the UK is much further along in that journey of losing its habitat, and is considered the most has lost the most habitat and the most nature deprived areas in country in Europe. Because of that, we've seen many species going extinct, but the blue carbon offers a solution potentially. And there's huge projects going ahead. Specifically, there's one with Swansea University, which is the biggest seagrass regrowth and planting projects in the world currently, where you literally go out with loads of volunteers and go out and collect seagrass seeds, and then have a whole, give them to kids to be able to pack into, as teach them how to kind of regrow these seagrass beds and why they're important. So there's an education piece in there as well. And then they take them out and diversify them out and lay them across the seabeds to hopefully restore the seagrass meadows and then sequester the carbon. Luckily, seagrass sequesters carbon much faster than even old growth and tropical forests. It can grow up to 30 times faster. So there's a huge potential for regrowth and for the solution to kind of come back in and really help us out with a quick solution to sequestering carbon in this case.
Thanks, Lawrence. And it's really interesting because across the three of you, there seems to be this theme here where a lot of the solutions we're talking about are very much community driven. So you mentioned about the involvement of school children in that project in Swansea. And you also mentioned the benefits of blue carbon solutions such as seagrass when it comes to sequestering carbon. Does it also have a role to play when it comes to climate adaptation, whether that be in the UK or anywhere else that has big sinks of blue carbon?
Yeah, massively. I think anyone who's been doing the course probably knows in the last lecture we had about the mangroves. Mangroves probably being the best example of adaptation for a nature-based solution because of their ability to protect people against cyclones or what we call hurricanes in the UK. And that's basically because the storm surge that comes in through mangroves is dissipated by going through those mangroves. So it's got a huge potential to let people to adapt to a warming world where these cyclones become more common, and you need to kind of build up your resilience against these kinds of events. And yeah, so they're a huge bit. And as part of that, as you say, the education piece is just giving people the opportunity to, or giving people the knowledge to know that if they chop down these mangroves, then they will be more of a risk for them. But you also have to put them in a position where they don't need to chop down those mangroves, and that education piece there, and providing an alternative solution and seeing the value in it, and valuing the nature in a different way to be able to best protect it, is a huge part of the solution.
Let's stick to this theme of the dual role of nature-based solutions in terms of its role in climate mitigation. Of course, by that we mean its role in sequestering carbon and its role in climate adaptation in terms of its ability to reduce communities' exposure and vulnerability to the effects of climate change. And we'll turn back to Q to try and tie this piece together. And find out what sort of solutions are being pursued, sort of nature-based solutions are being pursued in Malaysia, which have both those mitigation and adaptation benefits.
Yeah, Lorenzo, I think we've come full circle since we last talked about this with Wynn. And just like a quick recap for listeners, we had mentioned that when Malaysia launched its voluntary carbon market exchange, known as VCX, there weren't enough carbon credits generated locally, and so BCX had to run its first auction with credits generated abroad. But anyhow, there are ongoing nature-based solutions being executed in Malaysia, and one that's particularly in the spotlight is the Penang Nature-Based Climate Adaptation Program, which is designed to curb the urban heat island effect in Penang Island using nature-based solutions. So the program had actually secured $10 million from the Adaptation Fund, and it's addressing both mitigation and adaptation aspects. The initiatives include increasing green urban nature for carbon storage, increasing vegetation cover to help reduce outdoor temperatures, selecting more adaptable and climate resilient plant species, and also increasing public awareness of lifestyle changes with mitigation potential. Apart from that, another project that's still in incubation phase but gaining prominence within the region is the Kenya for Life project. It started out with the establishment of the Kenya State Park, where the state of Terengganu had gazetted about 30,000 hectares of the Kenya watershed. And the prominence of this watershed cannot be overstated, because it's not only adjacent to Taman Negara, our largest national park, but it's also rich in biodiversity, including diverse bird life and tigers. And so to prevent the state park from turning into another paper park, and also realizing that they needed to protect the greater Kenya watershed, which is another additional 200,000 hectares on top of the 30,000 hectares we had mentioned previously, the group basically formed a task force to secure sustainable financing for the protection of the area. So this task force consists of multiple partners working on different components, including developing state park regulations, conducting judiciary workshops to improve prosecution rates for wildlife, biodiversity monitoring of key species, empowering indigenous communities, and capacity building for forest patrols and big cats conservation. And all of this is done in consultation with the state government, which, as I've mentioned earlier, is very reliant on natural resources extraction for income. So the project fundamentally aims to transform the way forests are being viewed by state economies to demonstrate that there are alternative ways to receive economic benefits apart from extraction.
I think that's an interesting example of how, by bringing all key stakeholders with you, from state actors at the top to communities, you can do some really powerful, impactful things when it comes to conserving nature-based solutions and conserving wildlife. And just a quick follow-up, referring to the episode we did with Wynn Sim Tan a few weeks ago, do you think voluntary carbon markets have an important role in terms of making that economic case to state actors when it comes to wildlife conservation?
I think it serves as a good starting point, because when done right and you have players in place to try and make sure that VCMs are being done in the right manner, both from the buyer side and the supply side, so you have coalitions like VCMI as well as the ICVCM,
where they're starting to set up these frameworks and standards to try and make sure that the carbon credits that are going into these carbon markets are of very high integrity. And then this serves as a financial incentive for all of these state economies to see that there are alternative ways. But then fundamentally, what we want to do is that apart from that financial incentive, how do we make sure that all of these economies then see that there is value in preserving nature, whether or not you are using carbon markets as your outcome?
Interesting. Now, turning to Angel, you mentioned earlier the devastating consequences of forest fires and also subsequent flooding. How are Canadians adapting to the increased intensity and frequency of these natural disasters?
I think, well, maybe I'll talk about the government first, because individuals, I think, is a bit harder to capture. But last year, the government kind of had a wake-up call after the fires, even though personally, I think they should have woken up years ago.
What's a wake-up call?
A wake-up call.
A wake-up call. Nice. What is that? Should we be doing it in the UK?
But yes, the wake-up call was that they launched their first ever climate adaptation strategy aimed at reducing extreme weather risk like the wildfires. So it's meant to serve as a guidance on how governments, businesses, and individuals can collaborate on adaptation issues. So they've also increased some funding. So there's about like 1.5 billion Canadian dollars that are now going to support the adaptation strategy. But to be honest, that's not nearly enough. We need to scale those investments like almost immediately. Yeah, so one of the most interesting things to come out of this adaptation plan is that there is some guidance on the use of nature-based solutions. They've discovered that, wow, you know, nature actually can be a resilient force against climate change. Imagine that. But one of the explicit targets of this strategy is to conserve 25% of Canada's lands and waters by 2025, and then 30% of them by 2030. So to working to halt and reverse nature loss by 2030. So for example, so this is an example of a biodiversity nature-based solution. In the province of Nova Scotia, there's work being done on restoring salt marshes that helps to protect thousands of residents and businesses, a UNESCO World Heritage Site, Indigenous communities, etc., from flooding. So that's on the government side. On the individual side, I would say, unfortunately, I don't think there's much being done. I think Canada is in a uniquely privileged kind of standpoint where that, you know, we can be subject to these extreme events and just kind of go on with daily life. But for some people in Canada and obviously others worldwide, you know, this has to change. So we need to start adapting our behaviors and our, not just like consumption behaviors, but also just like our attitudes towards extreme weather events.
Mm. And you mentioned a key nature-based solution, peak carbon sink in Canada, which is, of course, the abundance of forests, like the boreal forest that you mentioned earlier. Are there any other really important natural carbon sinks in Canada? And are there any opportunities for human-induced, human-made carbon dioxide removal technologies?
Yeah, as you mentioned, yeah, the most obvious carbon sink is the forest, but unfortunately, due to the wildfires in the last couple of years, they have actually been a emitter, and it's quite sad to see. But however, due to the sheer size of the forest, obviously, they're still storing lots and lots of carbon that we should not touch. But yeah, jumping on your point about other carbon sinks, one that is less known about is actually soil carbon. So about 95% of Canada's terrestrial carbon is actually stored in the soil. It's underground. Only 5% is actually in the trees. So it's stored in the top meter of the soil. So Canada stores about a quarter of the world's total soil carbon in peatlands found in the boreal forest. And that's made of accumulated plant matter that's just been collecting over thousands of years. So it's estimated that there's 384 billion tons of carbon stored in that soil, which means that we need to work really hard to make sure that wildfires don't touch this land and disturb this vast reserve through, you know, emitting carbon. And then to your point on man-made CDR technologies, Canada is actually well poised to be a world leader in carbon dioxide removal. The key to most to unlocking most successful CDR technologies like direct air or direct ocean capture is access to vast amounts of clean electricity, which Canada has an abundance of. So provinces like British Columbia and I think Newfoundland generate over 90% of their electricity from hydroelectric sources. Canada also has a unique large geological makeup that make it well suited to sequester the carbon underground. So the depth and the porousness of the rock is really suited to sequestering carbon. So establishing a large scale Canadian carbon removal industry can also play a part in the just transition because, as you know, Canada has a lot of oil and gas industry so that we can pivot those already trained workers who have expertise on how to move fluids and gases between different reservoirs into working in carbon dioxide removal. So that keeps their livelihoods as well.
Interesting. Sounds like there's a range of opportunities there. I'm really struck by the variety of nature-based solutions as well. Obviously, forests are ones that immediately come to mind, but some of the others that you mentioned, such as the soil potential of Canada, are fascinating. Turning back to Lawrence, so the UK increasingly is going to become more and more vulnerable to flooding, particularly coastal areas. You've already talked about the role that mangroves can play in flood prevention. Are there any other solutions which can play a role, and how do you think UK communities living in coastal areas can adapt?
Yes, sure. I mean, there definitely are. I mean, one thing to look at as well as coastal areas are susceptible to flooding, but you can do stuff in the ocean and also on land. So just things like planting trees and hedges, which increase water absorption, catching rainfall to slow down surface runoff towards those areas, which, you know, all water eventually kind of goes out to the sea, and improving the soil cover and doing things in cities to improve sponge cities or implement sponge cities, for example, which, you know, hold water in them for faster. And for years we've known that if you put down concrete in places, water just runs up immediately faster into the oceans and faster into rivers, which causes flooding. And it also has the benefit of increasing biodiversity within those cities as well, we're making them greener and nicer to live in. I suppose on that front as well, I mean, you have the UK Environment Act, which is in 2021, which put into law that there should be a biodiversity net gain in any development of small sites. That came into action last month, the 12th of February. And that basically means that any new development is required to have at least 10% biodiversity net gain than what was there before the development happened. And that also just makes our cities and areas better to live in and just nicer to live in. In terms of actual flooding around that, specifically on coastal areas, everyone will know things like groins and seawalls and those kind of hard man-made defensive structures. But you can do things like restoration of beaches, of dunes and marshes, which Angel touched on as well, which help with biodiversity and just help to make the area which you're visiting much nicer to visit. I mean, for example, on the west coast of Wales, there's huge sand dunes there, and you don't even really notice that they're there. If you had a huge seawall groin, it just disrupts the kind of nature actually being out there. So in terms of my preferences, it's much better. And there's also just loads of volunteering groups that you have in the UK now. We had a talk from company called Young Wilders, which I'll give a shout out to the youth UN climate talk here at Imperial. And there's just so many different volunteering groups that plant trees and they're helping to kind of reduce the kind of impacts on people and kind of get people out into nature to re-interact with it as well, which is just an enjoyable thing to do.
Brilliant. And maybe in the show notes we can put a plug to Young Wilders, because that sounds like a great initiative, especially given we are a UK-based university. There's potentially opportunities for students to get involved in certain projects. I wanted to wrap up the episode on an optimistic note. I think we've actually started to do that because we've started to talk about some really interesting solutions and means by which nature can be deployed to help people adapt to the impacts of climate change. But my final question to each of you is, what recent news story or initiative from your countries has made you hopeful?
This is not so much a hit line, but more of just what I've observed personally around me. So I volunteer with the Malaysian Youth Delegation, shout out to NYD. And through NYD, I've had the opportunity to speak to many passionate youths within the country and learn about the fascinating work that they do. And one person that's really inspired me recently is Natasha Zulaika. So Natasha, she's founded a nonprofit called Coralku, which studies the heat resilience of different coral species, and she plants them in underwater nurseries. She's also doing her doctoral thesis at the same time, studying human-elephant conflicts from the lens of behavioral psychology. So it's really people like Natasha who are going on the ground and witnessing the effects of climate change and biodiversity loss firsthand, yet still keep doing what they do, who in turn motivate me and keep me going.
Wow, that is really inspiring, and probably the last time I'm going to complain about having different group assignments to do on this master's when you've got people with those sorts of responsibilities, one alongside the other. Angel, on to you.
Yeah, first of all, let me just say, I hope my parents never hear about Natasha, because they'll never let me hear the end of it. You could be doing your PhD. You could just be found out for a lot. But anyways, so just to circle back on the Indigenous communities, I've seen recently that Indigenous communities in Canada have been extremely proactive in the face of climate change and now are so heavily involved in the ownership of clean energy projects that they are now the largest owners of these assets, excluding utilities in Canada, which I think is just really remarkable. So these communities are owning, co-owning, or have a financial agreement in place for 20% of renewable energy projects in Canada. So they're actually leading the transition to a clean energy economy and gaining energy sovereignty through renewable resources. I'm really proud to share the same land as these Indigenous communities who are showing true resilience in the face of climate change, especially given that they are disproportionately affected by their effects.
Yeah, and I think that's really pertinent, because going back to the definition of nature-based solutions from the Nature-Based Solutions Initiative, it ends with respecting the rights, values and knowledges of local communities and Indigenous peoples. So we definitely need to always remember that. And last but not least, I'll turn to Lawrence.
You know what, I think I'll probably go back to the biodiversity net gain legislation, because the UK is the first country in the world to put it into law that you have to do that. And I think without doing that, you're not going to force people to make a change. People will do it because they see like a financial benefit. There are loads of good companies out there which are doing that and making money off of biodiversity credits and carbon credits, as we've touched on. But if you are to control the whole economy and change the whole system into being a sustainable one, then I think you need to come at it from a systemic point of view, and and I just think it creates a great environment to be in, and it's an exciting to see how people kind of put it into place and put it into action in the future.
Brilliant. Well, it leaves me to say a big thank you, Angel, Lawrence and Q, for your insights on Canada, the UK and Malaysia. I think that was a real tour de force, and I'm sure listeners learned a lot about the importance of nature-based solutions in the countries you call home. And I think you've set out perfectly the scale of the damage that's already been done and the scale of the challenge we have before us, but also the scale of the opportunity we have if we can harness nature-based solutions in our efforts to mitigate carbon emissions and to adapt to the impacts of climate change. And if you found this episode insightful and enjoyed this around the world format, then I encourage you to listen to the first episode in the series, which, as I said, was hosted by my co-host Ava. We spoke to students on the CCMF cohort about climate adaptation. And my co-hosts Jim and Marie-Céline will shortly be on the airwaves with the Around the World episodes on the transition from fossil fuels to clean energy and the importance of policy and economics in tackling climate change. So stay tuned, and thank you for listening to the episode. Bye.